This is John McMurray, and I'm sitting with Sheldon Oker, longtime baseball reporter who covered the Cleveland Indians for 33 seasons with the Akron Beacon Journal. And we are speaking today on February the 27th, 2018. And Sheldon, tell me what got you interested in baseball.
I was interested in baseball from the time I was about six. My father went to one of the World Series games in 48, brought home a program, and, you know, I don't remember this clearly about my interest, but I do remember I just leafed through that program so many times it was in shreds after a while. So I could tell you who played what in the 48 World Series for the Indians, but I have no recollection of any game. I mean, I know what happened at some of the games now, but I know I didn't. I don't recollect it from my own experience. And I guess this started there. And by the time I was eight, you know, I could tell you everybody who was in the lineup in the 1950 Indians. And of course, it was easier then. There was fewer teams, but. That's what probably started at the 48 World Series, my father going to one of the games.
Did you have a sense you wanted to be a baseball reporter at a young age as well?
Not that young. I probably, maybe junior high school. There was the guy who covered the Indians for the Beacon Journal is named Jim Schlemmer. Mm-hmm. And Jim covered it longer than I did. And in fact, somewhere around 1929 and 2013, Beacon Journal only had three beat writers for the Indians. And he did it from, I'm not exactly sure when he started, 29, 30, till 1970. And he was a provocative writer. He would say things, he would write things that everybody get mad about, especially the Indians. He got banned from the press box for a while. He was a bit of a racist, but I didn't understand that when I was a kid. He had the little code words for, he would say the Indians need more players from Ohio, which meant white players. And he had a couple other things that I figured out later on in life. But he was such a character, and his writing was a lot of analysis and opinions, and sometimes it was just cheap shots, but it attracted my interest. Mm-hmm. So that was probably had something to do with it. Mm-hmm. But I actually went to law school at Ohio State for four quarters, and I had a friend who had been in journalism school, and he dropped out of school, went in the Army, came back, and went back into journalism school when I was in law school. And I just decided that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I quit law school, and I took a couple quarters of journalism courses. I should have gotten a master's degree because I wouldn't have had such a low entry-level job. But the Ohio State didn't have a very good journalism school at the time, and they didn't have a director of the school. They had an interim director who was one of the who taught news writing and was an old newspaper man. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't an academic person. And I asked him. I says, "Well, what do you think about getting a master's?" "You don't need a master's. Just take these courses." And so I did for a couple quarters. And then I had to get a job because I was married, my wife was pregnant, and mm-hmm. I got a job at the Sandusky Register. Mm-hmm.
Did you covered basketball for a long time, for 10 years. Was your intention to go into basketball reporting so it would then lead to baseball reporting, or were you...
No, my intention wasn't even to be a sports writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I liked sports, and if there was three people there and one of them said, "Will you come to the news department?" And another one said sports department, and another one said features, I would have picked sports. But it just happened that my first opportunity was in sports. Mm-hmm. So I took the job. And the reason I cover the Cavaliers was the editor of the Beacon Journal at the time was Ben Maidenberg, who was like a legend in Akron, mm-hmm. But he was real quirky, and I was covering Akron U, and he was on the at this time some newspaper executives were involved in the community where they wouldn't be now. You wouldn't have a newspaper editor on the board of trustees of a university that you're covering. But at that time, the owner of the paper, John Knight, believed in community involvement for his people, mm-hmm. and his executives. And in fact, he and the president of Goodrich, Goodyear, and Ben, they ran the city. Mm-hmm. They were probably the three most powerful people in the city. So Ben was on the board of trustees, and at the time the university was going to give the rubber bowl to the city, or the other way around. They wanted the university to take the rubber bowl for a dollar, but the university had to spend I forget how much money in renovations and stuff. Mm-hmm. So one of the things they were going to do was. The rubber bowl, the lights are in front of the stands on these like telephone poles, mm-hmm. and they wanted to, or at least the university architect and some other people wanted to attach them to the back, mm-hmm. and it would be better lights. This was a time when color TV was becoming prominent, and you needed more light. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a column explaining all this. And I maybe had advocated for putting these better lights on. Well, there's an airport right next to the stadium, a small airport, and the FAA wasn't thrilled about having higher lights when planes are landing. And it probably wouldn't have made any difference, but you know, if they had their choice, they don't want it. And they were going to cost more than installing lights, the old style lights. So Ben reads his story and he gets mad. He didn't like it. So I thought, well, I'll just go over to his office, and when I explain it to him, he'll of course be on my side. Now I'd only been at the paper a couple of years at this time. So I go over and I get about three words out of my mouth, and he starts screaming and swearing at me, and how stupid is this, and where did you get this stuff? And I said, well, the university architect. And he said, well, what does he know about it? So anyway, people that covered Akron, you had this problem with Ben all the time. So he told the sports editor when their spring season was over, get Oker off of that beat. I don't want him covering Akron U. So the safest thing for me to do, the sports editor felt, was to cover the Cavaliers, because Ben didn't care about the Cavaliers. They weren't in the city. And I ended up covering the Cavaliers for 10 years because of that.
Do you feel that when you cover a sport, that you use the same skills covering basketball, or is baseball different when it comes to reporting?
It's different in the respect that each one has their own culture for the players. So dealing with the players can be different, because mm-hmm. every sport has its own little quirks and rituals and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Other than that, and then there's also there's more, like if you cover it in the NFL or even college football, there's more restrictions for a reporter. You don't get the same access as you did in the NBA or in baseball. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the NFL, well, you talk to the quarterbacks for 10 minutes on Tuesday, and you talk to the linemen for 15 minutes on Wednesday, it's very regimented. Basketball and baseball were not like that. And now, at the time, I didn't know the difference. You know, I found out from doing it. Basketball... now it's different now. I had great access to the coach, Bill Fitch. I could just walk into his office pretty much whenever I wanted. and talk to him. And the players now, I think the club, the locker room's open 45 minutes before the game. Mm-hmm. But people who cover it now tell me nobody wants to talk. I don't talk before the game. Mm-hmm. And you get a lot of this kind of stuff, which you never used to. Mm-hmm. You didn't have this guy's a, you don't want to talk to this guy because he's a jerk, or that guy, or the, there was like two guys in the league that wouldn't talk. Mm-hmm. Or that were uncooperative. Kareem mm-hmm. was one of them. And he, after a game, he would, there'd be, you know, four or five guys around him. He would turn his head away from the reporters and mumble. Mm-hmm. And he did it on purpose. Mm-hmm. Until he wrote a book. Then suddenly, don't you want to talk to me? I just wrote a book. So he was one guy, and Moses Malone was always difficult, but I think with him it was more of, he wasn't very articulate and he didn't like to speak to groups of people like that, but everybody else in the league was at least polite, and most of them were good to talk to. Well, I talked to Will Chamberlain a couple times, and he was great to talk to.
So you covered the Cavaliers in their formative years. You know, this team started in the
from early, the second from, you know, year to the 11th.
From the early 70s, they started. Bill Fitch was the coach.
Right.
The Miracle of Richfield in 76, and then they sort of went down again going into the late 70s and early 80s. What? Tell me about your transition from basketball into baseball reporting.
Well, the guy who, well, I guess I should say this. For 1970, when Jim Schlemmer retired, they needed a baseball writer. So the obvious guy was, his name was Bob Nold. He was a huge baseball fan. He would go to the games, and he'd have like six different colored pencils. And there's papers all over the place, and peanut shells, and every whatever particular stat had to be in a different color pencil. And you know, I couldn't bother him during a game because he'd lose track of which color pencil he was using. And but he wasn't much of a people person as far as. Stories, features, and stuff, even news things. I remember I was on the desk on a Saturday. I was running the desk on a Saturday. And, you know, they used to have the old, what do you call it, machines to send copy on the, like wire machines. Mm-hmm. Well, he would send, he very seldom sent anything on one of those machines, but he sent a little, pregame feature, and it was on what's his name? He didn't never talk to the media. I'm trying to think who it was for the Indians, outfielder. Oh my God, can't think of his name. Good player, good hitter. Anyway, so. Somebody comes in and brings me this little story, and it's about 10, 12 paragraphs. So it's about how the guy grips his bat, and his hands are here, and his fingers are here, and like nobody, who gives a shit, you know? Mm-hmm. It goes on for 8 paragraphs. The last 2 paragraphs is, this is why he and nobody, first of all, nobody talked to him. He wouldn't talk to anybody, and he was talking to Nold. Mm-hmm. And the last 2 paragraphs, or 3, were why I don't talk to the media, which is, of course, the entire story. I don't care about the rest of it. And I got so mad, I just, you know, ripped the first 8 paragraphs off and used the other 3. But that's the kind of baseball writer he was. It was, the only thing that counted was the game. So he didn't want to travel. So they let him do the home games, and I was supposed to do the road games. But I knew that once the Indians fell out of the race, they were going to quit covering the road. for the first time in like 40 years. And so that's what happened. But I covered the team for 3 months on the road. When Alvin Dark was manager, and he and Gay Paul were having this power struggle. It was the time when Tony Horton went crazy. I wasn't there that day, but I knew Tony Horton a little bit. Veda Pinson was on the team. He would, off the record, he would talk about, he thinks Alvin Dark's a racist and I don't like him. And, it wasn't a very prominent team, except Sam McDowell was on the team. One of their typical, you know, 78 and 84 teams or whatever. But anyway, I only did it for 3 months, and then 10 years I didn't do it after that. So I knew what it was like to cover baseball.
Mm-hmm. It, when you did start covering the Indians in the early 80s, they weren't very good. They had a lot of guys who were really good guys, but didn't go on to success with a lot of with really any other major league team, and there wasn't a lot of hopefulness around the Cleveland teams at that point. What's it like covering a baseball team when, you know they're going to be a perpetual 70 and 92?
Well, they usually weren't that bad. They were within like 4 or 5 games of 500 most of the time.
Okay.
And so, like,
that would make it 70, 78.
Yeah. So in spring training, everybody would, the media people were pretty realistic about the team, but there always was some hope because Gabe would always make it a point to make a big deal at the winter meetings.
Mm-hmm.
They would be the star of the winter meetings a lot. And he was also, Gabe considered himself like the first baseball PR guy, and that he thought he could manipulate things and spin things. And in some respects, he did. So it wasn't like, well, I know they're going to lose 100 games. It wasn't like that. And it didn't matter to me. I didn't care if, I was a fan of the team, but when you start covering it, all that goes away, or at least it did for me. It was just, I have this job and I'm covering the team, and I'm not going to root for the team in the paper or anything. That's not difficult. At least I didn't think it was. It seemed like a natural thing that once you're doing this for a living, you just don't look at it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, there's more to write about on a bad team than there is on a good team.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, because there's always some problem, or somebody's getting hurt, or somebody's shooting his mouth off, or there's more tension, so there's more more things happen to write about. So as far as I was concerned, it didn't matter to me that they were below 500 every year, most years.
Mm-hmm.
Now I did notice if guys that were on the team for 5-6 years in a row and they lost every year, that affected their psyches.
Mm-hmm.
And this, what they, you call losing mentality. They got used to losing, and I don't know if they actually expected to lose, but they didn't resist losing that much.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a problem for the Indians, although at that time I don't think they realized it, or they didn't try to fix that in their player personnel. Well, we got to get rid of these three guys because they've just lost too much and they don't care anymore. They didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Old type baseball people like Gabe and Phil Segi, they didn't think in those terms.
Mm-hmm. And you still got to see things that were, even things like Len Barker's perfect game, which
right.
you were in
81. That was my first year, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so you were there on that night, and that was a Friday, a very cold Friday night.
I think it was 47 degrees. It was like kind of damp, a drizzle.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was like 7,500 people there. after the game. It wasn't an exciting perfect game in the sense of there were no like great plays. I think somebody made a pretty good play. Yeah, but there were no leaping over the fence to catch something, or you know, four diving stops at third and that kind of thing. For the most part,
all the runs were scored early. I
think and the right. runs were scored early. what was it, 2-0 or 3-0?
3-0.
3-0. And so in the later innings, the tension was, well, it's a perfect game. But there was very little, if it was a movie, they wouldn't have scripted it that way.
Although Barker's momentum built. I mean, I think he struck out 11 after the fourth
inning. Yeah, initially he didn't strike out many guys. Mm-hmm. His curveball was really good that night.
He was either on or he was off. I mean,
there was a reason for that. I remember that season. He was getting dressed, and I'm looking at his elbow, and like right here, there's a golf ball size welt, or it's not a, it was swollen, like this. Mm-hmm. I said, Lenny, you got that, your arm's all swollen. I says, what's the deal? He says, well, that only hurts after the game. So, of course, now that was, I think that was 81 also, so.
But he was having control problems before that. Even
yeah,
when he was
well, he had always, yeah, he wasn't a big command guy.
Yeah.
But when he did have it, then you just didn't hit him.
Yeah, and I think Charbonneau was in that game. Rick Manning, George Orta.
Yeah, I remember Manning caught the last out.
Yeah, Ernie Witt.
It
was, I mean, and, you know, that team just, it wasn't always the best defensive team, but it was,
right.
They put it together that night.
Yeah, and I mean, it wasn't a bad team. Yeah. It was just, you know, kind of average. Mm-hmm. I remember after the game, Lenny called his grandmother. He lives in Bucks County, mm-hmm. near Philadelphia, and couldn't hear the conversation. But afterwards, Lenny says, "Well, I told my grandmother I pitched a perfect game. There was nobody on base," and she said, "That's okay, Lenny. Next time you'll do better." She didn't understand that.
So as you covered, you were saying before about how it's kind of becomes a, you know, you may have rooted for the team before, but once you start covering it, it becomes more of a job, or at least you have a little bit of a disconnect and so forth. So when you were able to cover the team, do you feel you've had you see a lot of reporters today that have rooting interests one way or the other. Do you feel that you were able to avoid putting your own personal rooting views into your stories?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that I always thought was the most important thing in my job, even though I'm supposed to just be a reporter, was telling people what I thought the team was going to do. Mm-hmm. What I thought they were going to do, and sometimes what I thought they should do, mm-hmm. or shouldn't do. And, I mean,
you're talking about strategy, or you're talking about
No. Okay. But yeah, how to actually, not strategy. I had my own rule for criticizing managers, mm-hmm. and usually there's more than one way to do things, mm-hmm. that makes sense. You know, bunt or not to bunt, you can make a case for either one in a certain situation. As long as a manager picked one that was sensible, even if it wasn't mine, mm-hmm. I'm not going to criticize him. Now, of course, obviously it's my judgment as to what's sensible and what isn't, but I thought that's about as objective as you can get.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't criticize managers very much, because they usually, you know, they're professionals. They they know better than I do most of the time. And if they picked something that made sense, I wouldn't do it that way, but I can understand why he did it. And there's some logic to it. Mm-hmm. So I didn't criticize much in that respect. And same with players. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't point out every mistake a player makes, because if it doesn't affect the game, or it's not something he does all the time. Now, if somebody makes the same mistake, you know, every other game, Yeah, that needs to be said. Or if it costs you three runs and you lose the game, that needs to be said. But for the most part, you know, I went with the attitude that it's a hard game to play. Nobody's perfect. And if you, unless the mistake is material, it's kind of like perjury. You know, you can lie, but if it's about something that's not central to the whatever the issue is that the law says. But if you lie in something meaningful, then it's perjury. And so I kind of use that same logic or same standard.
How did the players react to your columns? And when you were saying the Indians should do this, or perhaps should trade a certain player?
I had very little. The players almost never commented to me on something I wrote.
Is that because they felt you were fair in what you said? Or do you feel like
I don't know. So. Well, if they didn't read the paper, somebody would tell them. So. Yeah.
Kind of the same difference.
Yeah. So, and usually it was worse if somebody told them, because they don't tell them accurately. It
might make you look worse than what was actually.
I mean, if I criticize a player and somebody reads it and they tell a player, they want to make it like, well, we're helping the player, so I'll make it worse than it was. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody did. I mean, then that happened once in a while. I said, did you read that? And he said, well, somebody told me. Mm-hmm. I said, well, you need to read it, because that's not what it said. Mm-hmm. But it didn't happen very often. And I think part of the reason is I was there every day. Mm-hmm. So if a columnist did it, he's not going to be there the next day. Now, the player thinks he's not there the next day because he doesn't want to face the music. Yeah. But, of course, the truth is he has something else to do. But they looked at it as, well, this guy ripped me yesterday and he's not here today. So he's a chicken shit and I don't like him anymore. Mm-hmm. But the beat guy is there every day. So they respected that part. And I think after you do it a few years, they figure, well, he's done this for 5 years or 10 years. He must know something, mm-hmm. you know.
You know, and when you were starting, the game story meant a lot more than it does today.
Right.
You know, that fans relied on reporters to be their eyes and ears, and now they seem to rely on reporters to be more commentators than they do interpreting the action on the field.
Well, when I started, we were still a PM newspaper. Mm-hmm. So I was not the paper record. So I would try to stay away from the play-by-play stuff. And you end up talking about what happened in the game, but not in the same way that, like, the plane dealer did, because the plane dealer had to, you know, do it 15 minutes after the game was over, or an hour, whatever it was. And for at least a few years, I can't even remember what year we switched, but for a few years, we were a PM paper, and so I didn't have to... Or I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be the paper record and write those kind of stories.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think that reporting at that time was, in some sense, more pure? Because, you know, you had to go and dig it up from the very bottom. You didn't have to go to the internet and, you know, for the basis of a lot of your facts. It sounds as though a lot of what you were doing was 3 hours before the game or so, you were doing a lot of on-the-ground work, talking to players, and then you were watching the game, putting in, you know, 7 or 8 hours, whatever it is, of reporting per day. So you came out with a lot of original material, is that?
Yeah, although I think the guys who are still working for newspapers, excuse me, and they have to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. They have to do the same thing, but actually it's harder now. I mean, you work longer, because now you have to, the game's over, you have to rewrite it for the internet, do a blog, do this, you know, you're done at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
I didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. Even when the internet started and they started doing those things, I was older. Mm-hmm. And they thought, well, he doesn't know how to do this, and you know, log on to this and send this, and you know, do videos and all that stuff. And the truth is, if they would have asked me to start taking videos, which they did, Paul Hines has to take videos sometimes, I would have screwed it up immediately, so they wouldn't ask me anymore.
So what do you gain by watching the game in person as opposed to television as a reporter?
Well, for one thing, there's other people there. So if you don't see everything, somebody else did. That's one thing. The collectiveness of it. You don't see how the outfield is positioned, let's say. You don't always get a sense, because the camera has to be, the director has to be good enough to switch to various cameras in a timely fashion. And you could miss, like, an outfielder's route to the ball, for example, or a real sharply hit ground ball to third. It takes, you know, a millimeter of a second to make that switch, and you might not see how the fielder reacted right away. you see the whole picture at once. Same with football. Football's a great sport for TV, but you don't see where the defensive backs are unless they replay it. You also get a different sense of that this is it's more real when you're there. When you watch it on TV, it's kind of a TV show. Mm-hmm. It's not really, but it seems like it. there is an advantage to being there. Plus, you have, not only are you there in person, but you have the replays too. Mm-hmm. You have TVs there, and you can see something replayed. And if there's something you really need that you missed the replay, you can go to the PR guy and say, "Can so and so run this back, and so I can watch it."
Now, you, when you're covering a team, any team, do you normally cultivate one or two sources that are sort of go-to people for you throughout the course of the year? Do you try and be even-handed to every player as much as you can be, or do you tend to go toward the stars because you feel that's what the fans want to hear from?
Well, I try to go to the person who's relevant that day. Now, if there's an issue, you know, ongoing issue, mm-hmm. yeah, there'd be two or three guys that you would more likely go to.
Like, you were covering the Indians during the Albert Bell era, and of course Bell was very notoriously media unfriendly, yet he was the most important player on the team, 95 in particular, where he hit 50 home runs and 50 doubles, one of the best seasons that we've ever seen in baseball, and yet you have to cover a team with a guy who really isn't cooperative with the media. How does...
Albert Wood, he got a little worse every year. When he was a rookie, he talked more than he did the next year, and he talked more the year that year than he did the year after, and he got less and less approachable. But when he got in trouble is when he would talk, because he wanted to explain his side. So when he ran into... what's the kid's name in Milwaukee? It was rookie of the year.
Oh, Valentin?
No.
the second baseman? I think, wasn't it Jose Valentin?
No,
I
could remember.
Okay. Fernando Vina.
Oh, God. No, I can't think of it. He was one rookie of the year. When somebody from the Indians should have won rookie of the year. Anyway, he ran over him on the base pass.
Listash, okay.
Yeah, okay. Listash. And Albert went into him like this. I was kind of on Albert's side on this. But anyway, he wanted to talk after that because he wanted to explain his side of it. There was a few other times when he would do that. There were some times when they wouldn't let him. Mm-hmm. Like when he turned around and threw the ball and hit the guy in the chest.
Yeah.
He was nowhere to be seen after
that. Tomczyk, the Sports Illustrated.
Oh, no, that okay. I mean the fan.
Oh, the fan, okay.
When he was in left field, the guy was yelling at him
Okay. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Cake party at Albert's. That's right. Or Joey's. He was still Joey then. Yeah, when he threw it to the photographer. He didn't talk then, I don't remember. But he was, I think if somebody doesn't want to talk, I don't care. As long as they don't talk to anybody else.
Yeah.
I don't care if they don't want to talk. That's one less guy I have to worry about. even if it's a guy that hit four home runs. Well, if he's not talking to anybody, I'm not losing anything. I know what he's going to say anyway, for the most part. I had Bill Fitch one time tell me that after a game, they lost the game, and and I go to talk to him. He goes, "You know what? Just go make up the quotes. You know what I say," which I didn't. But I mean, after a while, you, especially with a particular person, you know what they're going to say. So I always thought quotes were overrated.
Yeah,
you know, so once in a while you get a good one, but we use too many quotes because you're supposed to put quotes in the story, and it's an easy way to fill up space.
And most of sports writing throughout the century didn't rely heavily on quotes
until the 70s. I think Dick Young was like the first guy to really went in the clubhouse and talk to players. I mean, obviously it's a good idea, but it's, putting, and now it's worse because everybody records the quotes.
Yeah.
So instead of being this long, because that's only as much you can keep up with, now they're this long, and that's worse. You get the bad part of the quote and the good part of the quote, if there is a good part.
Now, Indians were not very good in 1980s. 1990s, mid-90s was a big change. They got the new stadium starting in 94. Influx of young talent, several Hall of Fame caliber talents. You know, you had Tommy, Manny Ramirez, Bell, Vizquel, Carlos Baerga. All these guys came together. You know, in a collection we may not see again anytime soon. A team that you had a lot of confidence would come back from almost any deficit, but it had good pitching too. So it was a completely different vibe covering the team in the 90s, mid-90s, than it was in the 1980s when they were a legitimate World Series contender. And you were saying before about how it was easy to, or in some ways, because there was a lot of controversy around a bad team, and here you are then covering a very good team, which certainly Cleveland fans weren't used to. What was it like in the 1990s covering that team, both for you and from what you observed of the fans?
Well, as far as myself and really everybody else who covered it, you knew there was more people paying attention, more people were reading the stories. You got more letters. Or would they have emails by then? emails, you had more attention. You would have talk shows calling you from different parts of the country. If I did an interview on the radio or television, the Beacon Journal would pay me like $20 or something. Mm-hmm. And I remember, so I had to keep track. And I think one year I did about 30 of these, or 35. Mm-hmm. Now, in the 1987, when they lost 100 games, I would have done, one. So there was that difference. You just knew more people were paying attention. Of course, the clubhouse was, for the most part, guys are having a good time. So players are easier to deal with. It was not an easy clubhouse for the manager. Mm-hmm. Some of the writers thought it was a hard clubhouse. I didn't. Albert was one reason. Kenny Lofton, who somehow got it in his head that when you're a Major League Baseball player, you're supposed to be a jerk. Because he really isn't. Mm-hmm. But, he would be hard to deal with it sometimes. Well, what he would do is you go up to him and you'd ask him a question. He'd say, "What do you want to know that for?" And so most people are immediately turned off. I figured out his game after a while. And I would say, "Well, I want to know because of this." and you had to be kind of aggressive with him. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you were, he would drop his bullshit bad guy pose, and he'd be a regular guy. But a lot of people who came in the clubhouse, you know, once a week or whatever, they didn't like Kenny at all. And he was difficult for people. Dennis Martinez was difficult for the front office, especially. He was great with the writers, but he would do things like one time they traded Julian Taveras. So, you know, another Latin guy. So the Indians would go to Dennis before the trade, and they would tell him and explain why they were doing it. And Dennis, in this particular trade, Dennis, oh, I understand, that's fine, I think you should do it. Well, when they made the deal, you know, we're going around the room, what do you think of this? So we get to Dennis, and Dennis starts ripping him. How could they trade Julian? What kind of thing is that? That's just stupid. And the front office would, you know, John Hart would go nuts. And so would Hargrove, because we told him and he said it was fine. And then he tells you guys it was a bad thing to do. And he did that more than once. So the front office didn't like Dennis. And it was a hard clubhouse to manage because of guys like Dennis and Albert, Eddie Murray. that was another guy that was touchy to deal with. If you got on Eddie's list, forget it. You were on there permanently, and he didn't want to have anything to do with you. I fortunately never got on his list, but he was only here a couple of years. But he was always nice to me. But
you always had very cooperative guys, at least Sandy Alomar.
Oh, you had some great, yeah.
Vizquel.
Well, like I said, Dennis.
Charles Nagy.
Dennis was great with the writers, yeah. But he wasn't with the manager in the front office. Mm-hmm. No, you had, you know, Bayardo was real good. Tomey was you know, very cooperative. Jimmy didn't have a lot of great insights, but yeah, he's the nicest guy you could ever meet. The Omar was good. He had a lot of good guys. Mm-hmm. But when you have, even if you only have two or three problems, then it becomes a difficult clubhouse.
When you're in a clubhouse like that, or any clubhouse, do you try and become friends with these players? Do you try and keep a professional distance?
Well, I mean, you don't talk about your kids and stuff. I mean, I tried to be friendly, you know. I knew I wasn't going to be friends with them. I got to be friends with, I think, one player, and no. Like 30 years. Julio Franco.
Yeah.
But, you know, I try to be friendly with people.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. Mm. And most at that time, whatever a player's personality was, I mean, you were there every single day. Mm-hmm. And he was there every single day. And you know you're going to know his personality. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, that's not true. Yeah. Because baseball had all these PR consultants, and the players, when they're in the minors, they take these lessons. Mm-hmm. Be polite, answer the question. Don't get personal. Don't show them your personality. Mm-hmm. Just do what you're supposed to do and get out. Mm-hmm. Now, I think this is really stupid, and if I was a PR guy, a consultant, I wouldn't tell them this. The guys who get the most endorsements, get the best press, have the best reputations, mm-hmm. are the guys who are media friendly.
Yeah.
And that means you do show them your personality. Now, most guys don't do that. Some guys still do. Now, it also means that if they're in a bad mood or they don't like you or, you know, they're going to, you're going to have arguments, you're going to have this. But that was okay. I mean, I never thought that was that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. You know, if a guy doesn't like somebody, he tells you, and you say, well, this is why I did it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yell at each other for 2 minutes, it's over. most of the time. Mm-hmm. There was a few guys like Eddie who it was just, you were done if you got on his bad side. I know Peter Gammons wrote something about his brother once. I can't even remember what it was.
But Rich Murray, the old giant?
Yeah. And Eddie would never talk to him again, to this day, probably. But there are not many guys like that.
Mm-hmm. Since you mentioned it, Julio Franco, you said was as close as you had to having a friend. And Julio got here in the early 80s. I think it wasn't that the Von Hayes deal? And Julio was a shortstop and had somewhat of a scattershot arm at the time. And I know got a lot of criticism just because he was such a raw talent at that particular time and sort of thought of it.
Well, he was a... I mean, he
great
had
hitter.
A maturity of a 14-year-old. When he came here for a press conference in the middle of winter. They made the deal at the winter meetings. He came here for a press conference, didn't have a coat. Mm-hmm. He had $5,000 in his sock, which I didn't know about at the time. Mm-hmm. And you know how they put a big, you know, Indians banner on the wall behind for a backdrop. He wanted to know if he could have that, take it home with him. And he wanted to know where the casino was. Now, this is when he said he was 21. He was really 23. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I just, when he was on the team, I used to talk to him quite a bit. And he was, we'd get in these fights. And one time he says, I want to make $1 million. He'd been here for 2-3 years. Mm. He wasn't close to free agency yet, though. He says, I want to make $1 million. I said, well, good for you. I do, too. I says, you'll make $1 million. I won't, but you're not going to do it now. Well, they should pay me $1 million now. Mm-hmm. I said, well, that's fine. They're not going to pay you $1 million. So we go back and forth, and you know, finally it just ends. So the next day, we went to Minnesota, and it's about 3 hours before the game. I'm sitting in the dugout, and Julio comes out. And this is one day after he wants $1 million on a long-term contract. I want to be traded. I says, okay. Now, Paul Hoynes is standing there, and he starts writing this stuff down. I says, Hoynes, you're going to look like a fool if you write this, because he doesn't want to be traded. This is his today's speech, you know, what he wants to say and get off his chest. Mm-hmm. And so we start arguing about it. He says, they're not going to trade you. It doesn't matter what you want. And they're not going to trade you, so forget it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the next day it was like, did I say that? You know, mm-hmm. Wayne's put it in the paper, I think. Mm-hmm. So that we had this kind of relationship. One time we were arguing about something in his locker, and Carmelo Castillo had the locker next to him. And Carmelo says, you guys sound like you're married. And we stopped. But, and of course I didn't see Julio after his, I didn't see him very often after he was traded, but I'd see him. Yeah, I'd go see him in spring training when he was with the Mets and Atlanta. Was he in Atlanta?
Yeah.
Because we were in Florida, he was in Florida, so we'd see each other some. And, he told me he wanted to be a manager, and I says, "Will you go to the minors and be a manager?" He says, "Oh yeah." He says, "I'll manage in the minor leagues," and he did actually. Mm-hmm. Well, I think he's, I don't know what he's still, I think he's overseas managing somebody, player manager, when he's 58. Yeah. Whatever. But
it's now it in the 80s you became the national president of the Baseball Writers Association of America.
Yeah.
And I wanted, I mean, obviously that we hear about that organization now mostly in the context of voting for the Hall of Fame. But I wanted to ask, you know, what that role entailed for you at that particular time, and how you felt you had an impact on baseball reporting writ large.
I had no impact on baseball reporting. It's not ceremonial, but the secretary of the organization is most of the real work. And it's the he's the same guy every year. You preside over the three meetings. There's a meeting at the All-Star Game, winter meetings, World Series. And, you know, there's issues that you try to resolve, local issues. You know, so-and-so, they didn't let us into the locker room 5 days in a row until, you know, 20 minutes late or whatever it was, stuff like that. And once in a while, yeah, sometimes you have, not when I was present, but they had a long-running issue of TV wanting to announce the our awards, you know, MVP, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the old line guys didn't want to do it, that it's somehow not pure to have TV announce this before we announce it. Mm-hmm. Or to have that be the announcement. They were willing to pay a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I said, what's the big deal? You know, it's... But it didn't happen for now. They do it now, but it's... I don't know if they get any money now or not, actually. That MLB Network does it.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they pay the baseball writers or not. Mm-hmm. And it could have been a good charity thing to do, but... That fight went on for years, but that was after I was president. Mm-hmm. So the year I was president, where there was no big major things that I recall.
You were also national correspondent for the Sporting News and for Sports Illustrated.
I didn't know that.
I read it. I imagine also at the time when they wanted to have a correspondent in each city who was kind of the voice who could say, well, here's what's going on, you know, back in with a particular team.
Yeah.
So it was a role that probably would be very different in the internet in the internet age, right?
Well, they stopped. The Sports Illustrated stopped doing it. They just didn't want to pay all these guys. Well, they couldn't afford to pay all these guys. So they ended up, and I don't even know what they do now, but they limited it to a few guys in the really the biggest cities.
Mm-hmm. You were obviously writing a lot, writing at least a story every day there was a game, most likely. And so, I mean, that's a lot of copy to generate, and especially if you're doing other things for whether...
Well, the Sports Illustrated stuff was... Mm-hmm. I wasn't writing stories. I was just sending them information
about it.
The Sporting News, yeah, you had to write a, mm-hmm. like, I forget how much, 300 words. Okay. But, you know, it's once a week, and
still, over the course of a week during the baseball season, it's a lot of writing that you need to put together.
You do about, or at least I, when computers started and they started counting, you could count the stories. Mm-hmm. I think I would write about 420 stories a year. Mm. I think that's what it was about. And now I'm not counting rewrites, you know, one deadline to the next. But
it seems as though your stories always had a starting point and an end point. In other words, you're trying to answer a question in the stories most of the time.
Yeah.
And you also interspersed historical allusions. I know there was a story I read about Fausto Carmona, and you were mentioning that he could be kind of like, but maybe like Sam McDowell in terms of a potential flame out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, so, I don't have any recollection.
But, I mean, it's also there's... but I get the sense that it is correct to say that you were trying to answer a question in the stories, and I didn't know if that was an intentional approach.
I looked at the baseball season as a soap opera, and you have plot lines, mm-hmm. and some go off and then this way, and some go off this way, and some just kind of die out, mm-hmm. and that you needed to follow the storylines of the season. And that's how I looked at it. And, yeah, I try to answer questions, you know, like, what are they going to do about this? What should they do about that? Mm-hmm. And even in game stories, I would try to have some, just avoid in the first inning, this happened in the second inning. So I would not, I write pretty fast. So mm-hmm. I would wait until at least the seventh inning before I started. So I'd get a sense, you know, usually games don't change after the seventh inning. Mm-hmm. And So I would start in some, maybe I'd talk about the pitcher or somebody hit two home runs and a double or, you know, and maybe talk about him for whatever. Not that he just hit the, got those hits, but some other, is this guy going to emerge as this or whatever? Is he out of his slump? Or so I would wait as long as I could. So I to avoid the AM kind of story, even though I was AM writer by that time. And usually it worked out okay. And sometimes I'd have time to go out, go run to the clubhouse. And I only had, there was only certain questions that I wanted to answer because I already wrote, you know, the theme that I wanted. Now, if somebody had a real good quote that would, had nothing to do with what I was writing, I'd figure out some way to get it in. But usually, well, I want to know this, this, or this, and I don't care about the rest. I don't care about what pitch the guy, I always thought that was stupid anyway. Well, did you hit a fastball or a curveball? Or, and half the guys don't know. They just tell you they do. And who cares? I didn't like those kind of questions. But that's how I approached it.
There's a famous quote that John Hart said, you know, it's like Sheldon Oakers in our meetings, you know, as you were talking about trying to anticipate, you know, what might happen down the line.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest compliments I ever got. And he said it at a party. It was like a World Series party or All-Star game. And I can't remember who he was talking to. Some baseball guy. And he introduced me to the guy, and that's what he said. Mm-hmm. He says, "I don't know, this guy, like, he's always in our, it's like he's in our meetings." Mm-hmm. And
so what kind of reporting were you doing that got you this inside information that, you know, thought was almost so good?
Some of it was, John would tell you things. Mm-hmm. Not directly, usually, but he had, I don't even know if he knew that he was telegraphing things. But like if he said, let's say they're, you knew they were trying to trade for somebody, or and if he said, that's an interesting guy, if he said those are, that means that's a guy he liked and he'd like to have him. Mm-hmm. So you knew that. And sometimes he'd tell you, you know, almost directly. But it would be in situations like I'd have to get him in the dining room or the, just sit down and start talking. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't ever write anything down, you know, because I didn't know if he was going to say anything. And sometimes it was just conversation. I wasn't expecting to get any information. But it would be when we were one-on-one, usually. Mm-hmm. Although he would do his code words in a group, too, but they weren't code words to anybody else. They were just code words to me.
So most of the idea that you were in his meetings was really stuff that was coming directly from John Hart.
Well, some of it was. I mean, some of it is just logic.
Yeah.
I mean, if, you know, 2 and 2 is 4, mm-hmm. and, you know, even if it's like 3 + 2 + 8 / 3 mm-hmm. multiplied by 6, yeah. More complicated, it's still, if you follow it all out, you're going to be right a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. So that, I don't know, you know, some of it was what people said, some of it was, you just figure it out.
As you covered baseball in the late 1990s, early 2000s, what we now call the steroid era, a lot of times reporters say, you know, I could have seen things that now in retrospect look obvious. What's the reporter's obligation, is there one, to sort of be ahead of the curve and say, hey, I have these suspicions about various things? Or do you have to sort of stay a little bit behind and say, I need more actual hardcore confirmation before I can go with something like that?
Well, something like that, you just can't say, gee, so-and-so has acne on his neck and he has a steroid personality, so he must be, you can't write that. Mm-hmm. I resent the people who said that the guys covering the beach should have been the one breaking these stories. They couldn't. Mm-hmm. First of all, nobody would talk about it. Mm-hmm. You can't rummage through some guy's locker and see if what's in there. Mm-hmm. The trainers aren't going to tell you what they're doing back there. You knew if a guy had, like, he had acne on his neck, or his head got bigger, or all of a sudden he would be, his personality would be like this, and he'd go from angry to calm in, 5 seconds. And yeah, we knew a lot of the people who were doing steroids, but we couldn't write it. We had no evidence. And the only way that evidence came out eventually was through the court documents in the Balco case.
Yeah.
Nobody got it directly from players or managers or people like that. It was, you had access to public records in a court case. Mm-hmm. And so that's what broke the story. And it's the only way you could have. Mm-hmm. Unless you had a retired player like Canseco, who yeah. shot his mouth open. Nobody believed him.
Wrote a book, yeah.
Which was stupid. I don't know why nobody believed him. They when he wrote that book, the publisher has like 14 lawyers go over it. They don't want to get sued. Mm-hmm. So I knew immediately what he said was the truth, because mm-hmm. the publisher wouldn't have put the book out. Mm-hmm. But the only way you were going to get to the bottom of that was something like the two guys, what are their names? I know one of them. We're doing investigating the Balco case.
Oh, Mark, the Sports Illustrated guys.
One of them wasn't. Yeah. God. Well, anyway, actually, there's two. I didn't know that guy. I knew his brother. His brother was a. Covered the Reds for a while. Well, anyway, but that's the only way you were going to get into that.
Now, for purposes of the Hall of Fame, we often hear from, how the writers need to evaluate players from this particular era. Sometimes you hear an argument that if a guy was a Hall of Famer before he took steroids, we should consider him as in. Others say, well, if everybody was doing it, then it all kind of cancels each other out, and we need to take the best players from that era. And other people say, if anyone was using any steroids, or even think they were using any steroids, they shouldn't be in. Where do you come down on this issue?
Well, the argument that everybody was doing it, and we didn't catch everybody, so we shouldn't punish the ones that we know did it. Mm-hmm. Let's say there's 12 7-Eleven robberies in Cleveland, and they know there's like 4, 5, 6, 8 guys, and they catch 2 of them. Should we let those 2 guys go because we can't catch the other 6? Well, that's what they're saying.
Yeah, right.
And the other thing about this, splitting their careers, well, David Justice probably, how many seasons did he play? 14, 15?
About that, yeah.
He probably had 5 or 6 that were Hall of Fame worthy. Mm-hmm. So should we just count those and not count the other? Because that's what they're saying about this.
Which is not the way it works. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's one career. The guy didn't follow the rules in a serious fashion. Mm-hmm. This is not the guy used a cork bat one time and got caught. Mm-hmm. This is changing his body with an illegal substance. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not supposed to have this to start with.
I guess the argument could be that, well, before they started testing for it around 2003, it was at least legal by baseball's rules. Therefore,
It wasn't.
Or at least wasn't tested for by baseball's rules.
Who was the commissioner in 91? I think it was 91 that they... Whoever the commissioner was says, you're not allowed to use steroids. Mm-hmm. I know we can't enforce it because the players' union won't agree to that. Mm-hmm. But it was a rule. You weren't allowed to use it then. Mm-hmm. They did have a rule against it. Mm-hmm.
So your view is that someone like Barry Bonds would not be...
I don't vote for him.
You would not vote for him under any circumstance. And you see sometimes people changing their views on these things.
Well, the more distance you put between the event and... Now, mm-hmm. the more people are going to vote for these people. And I understand, I get that, but I don't think it's right, but I get it.
So how do we evaluate it?
Well, I mean, there's some guys that you kind of know did it,
yeah.
but there's really no evidence at all. Mm-hmm. And I'll vote for those guys.
So what do we do if we have certain steroid people in the Hall of Fame now, and we find out later on?
Well, O.J. Simpson's in the football
Hall of Fame.
Right? They're not going to take him out.
And the Hall of Fame is never going to be a perfect place, and
right.
certainly a lot of the people who are in there now, if we had them to vote in again, we wouldn't do it for various reasons.
Yeah.
So your view is that where do we draw the line? Should it be on people who are known users, or we have some at least some evidence, or people that we suspect strongly used it, but we can't quite say.
Well, I think you have to have, you know, and I can't put this in an exact standard, but people that you have pretty good evidence. Mm-hmm. If it's just suspicion, no, I don't think that's fair either.
Is it fair to wait on some of these guys until maybe we get more evidence down the line? Is more things?
Well, I mean, you're only eligible for so many years.
Yeah,
so
that's right. Although in some ways you're eligible in perpetuity with the
those guys will never let these people in. Yeah. If they don't, if Barry Bonds and Manny and who else is still left?
Clemens.
Yeah. If they're not voted in, I don't think they're ever going to get in, because the guys in the committee are not going to.
Yeah, well, we saw the Joe Morgan letter a year or so ago that seemed pretty.
Yeah, they're not going to let them in. But, you know, Clemens and Bonds might get voted in.
They're certainly
creeping up a little bit every year.
And of course, you even see, it seems like an odd process in the sense of now, I don't ever recall this being happening before, where now guys sort of have momentum, where you know 2 or 3 years before they get in, they're going to get in. We see it with Edgar Martinez. For some reason, right. He's reached a point where now, in year 10 or so, they want to flip a switch and say now he's a Hall of Famer, and obviously nothing changed with his numbers.
Right.
And
well, I've always, after the first couple of years, I voted for him.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes it takes me a while to decide, but it's not fair to hold it against him. It's the DH. Yeah. DH is a position in baseball now.
In the same way, punter is a position in football.
Right. I mean,
you can't, you know, for a while they didn't put punters in the Hall of Fame, but it's still a position.
I mean, Edgar Martinez should be in the Hall of Fame.
I guess it was more speaking to the point of the idea that when he first got on the ballot, there wasn't a lot of support.
Few,
and now there's this sort of crescendo of momentum that I'm not quite sure where it came from, because he's about to leave the ballot.
Part of it is this distance thing. Yeah. When he went on the ballot, he's a DH, I'm not voting for him. Well, after a few years, that kind of fades a little bit as a reason for most people.
What's your philosophy on the Hall of Fame in general? Should it be a place for the best of the best, the Mays, Aaron Ruth types, or should it be a place where we have, you know, very very good sustained excellence, the Sutton, Cott, Tommy John types, or where do we draw the line?
Well, for me, it's if you're really dominant for 6, 8, 10 years, like Koufax.
Okay.
Or you play for 20 years and you're really good, there's somebody trying to take your job every year.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can hang around for 20 years and be productive, you ought to, and you've performed at a very high level. Maybe you only won 20 games once, but you pitched, you averaged, you know, like 14 or 15 for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think that qualifies you too.
So you're describing the guys with a super high peak, like Koufax, or the guys who do it for a really, really long time, like Sutton, as getting in. But then we have a whole bunch of guys who are kind of in the middle. Jack Morris.
You know, well, see, that was you named a guy that I voted for him every year. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe it's you have to see him pitch.
Mm-hmm.
The Sabre guys don't like him, of course, because he doesn't
high ERA, now 300 wins, all of that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, but he was the best pitcher of his decade.
Winningest pitcher of the 80s.
Right.
So.
And I think the numbers are useful.
Mm-hmm.
But they certainly aren't everything.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that, and Oakland A's found that out to their detriment when they tried to use numbers only as to do their player personnel stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't work.
Well, take someone like Mike Mussina. You know, didn't get 300 wins, retired before he had to, didn't play on a World Series winner, didn't win a Cy Young or any particular major statistical achievement, but still very good for a very long time, could have been a top pitcher on a contending team, as which he was. What do you do with someone like him?
Well, I don't vote for Mussina.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's right on the border. I didn't vote for Alex Rammel. To me, he was... first of all, you never said Trammell's name by himself. It was always Trammell and Whitaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like they're one person.
Tinker Evers Johnson.
And I thought Trammell was really good. I mean, I saw him play a lot. I thought he was really good, but I didn't think he was a Hall of Fame guy. Mm-hmm. Same with Mussina. The guy that really, I have a really big problem with is Schilling.
Yeah.
Because he was so good in the playoffs.
Yeah.
But not nearly as good in the regular season. I don't know what to do with a guy like that. I just don't. I don't know what to do with a guy like that.
You could argue that because the postseason has taken on a greater emphasis.
Well, I know all the arguments, but I still don't know what to do with him. And I know some guys don't vote for him because of politics.
Yeah.
Because they've told me.
He seems like he's stuck in the middle somewhere. So.
Yeah.
Or take someone, you know, like Albert Bell, I mean, who reasonably would have had an MVP had he been more cooperative with the press. Had a very high peak, was
well, he also pace. Didn't play long enough.
You didn't play long enough. But you were also talking about, well, Koufax,
right.
You know, had those six, no one's Koufax, but,
yeah.
You know, had five really good years before he got hurt. I mean, is that someone who would be?
Well, Albert certainly should have been on the ballot longer.
Yeah.
I was surprised that he disappeared so fast.
Yeah.
One guy that's probably going to be argued about is Omar.
Yeah, although it seems to me
he's got a pretty good start.
Consistently a pretty good start, but it seems odd, this whole thing of where you start and percentages and transferring 30 to 40 and 40 to 50 is a new thing. This didn't happen.
Right, it is.
And people tracking votes and all this sort of thing.
I think there may be more turnover mm-hmm. in the voters. Than
yeah.
there used to be.
And more younger voters
and more younger voters.
And I guess they've gotten rid of a lot of people who were on the rolls before. But
yeah.
Do you get lobbied on these things particularly?
Once in a while there's a player that somebody is backing and they'll send you an email or, you know, not a lot.
Coordinated campaigns, but...
They'll be coordinated, but they'll be pretty low key.
If you have to think about it for 10 years, does that say to you someone is not a Hall of Famer?
Probably, unless sometimes you can vote for 10 guys. So,
yeah.
Well, I like these 10 guys for sure. I'm not sure about these guys. Mm-hmm. So it can delay. There can be a delay because of that.
Some argue we just need to get rid of the 10-person limit. There are just too many viable candidates on the ballot. And if we just could vote for as many as we wanted, we have people going in, it would help the sport.
I think there should be a limit.
And what's
it's too easy to go to say, I can vote for this guy now. Well, I'm not sure about him, but what the hell, I'll vote for him.
Well, part of the cachet is the selectivity of the Hall of Fame, the idea that some years we may not have a lot of people get in. I think in football they have to have at least five or maybe seven or something
right.
like that. Every year, no matter what is out there,
right.
You'll have to take them. In baseball, some years, even recently, they've had no one.
Yeah.
There's a certain cachet.
I think that's okay. I kind of like the way they do it. I would like to include team announcers, but they work for a team, and it'd be really hard for them to lose their objectivity. They're getting paid by teams.
In some cases, you see television announcers wearing team shirts on the broadcast.
But, I mean, they see a lot of games, and they see a lot of players,
yeah.
And they have to watch closely because they're telling you what's going on.
Yeah,
but. I don't know how to overcome the other part.
That's a tough one. who would you most want to see in the Hall of Fame that isn't in?
Well, up till this year with Jack Morris.
Okay, but
now, God, who's left?
And I guess it speaks to another question of.
Well, I mean, I think Omar should be in.
Yeah,
but
He probably will be at some point. This may take a little while.
Yeah.
In fact,
I was glad he went to the National League because then those guys would get to see him.
Yeah, and he was a defensive wonder, and he got something like 2,600 hits over time, you know. Somewhere in that range.
I think it was 2,800.
2,800, so, I mean.
The other thing was that, and I never, before you could just press a couple buttons on the computer and look it up, I would figure out his, because I had a sense that he was good hitter from the seventh inning on, mm-hmm. and I would go through my scorebook for a whole year, and he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't do it every year, but nobody noticed that because he didn't hit any home runs.
Yeah.
But I think if if you looked it up now, what he did from the seventh, not when he was with Seattle, because he didn't know how to hit then, but once he got to Cleveland and
Felix Fermin trade, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's when I knew John Hart was a good baseball talent evaluator, when he got Felix. Because who the hell is this guy? You know, he was a pretty good shortstop. Yeah. He hit, but he was a good shortstop.
Yeah, definitely good defensively.
Yeah.
It this summer you will be receiving the J.G. Taylor Spink Award, and for your meritorious service to sports writing over a long period of time, and going to the Hall of Fame in July. Tell me about, I mean, obviously that award has a lot of notable names who've won it. Everyone from Ring Lardner, David Runyon, Fred Lieb, Dan Shaughnessy, a modern winner. What does that selection of that award say to you about the importance of sports writing and the endurance of your work?
Well, I don't know about the endurance of my work. I think that's pretty much gone for most people. I mean, some people like you would look it up for historical reasons. I think, you know, in the newspaper they call the sports department the toy department. And that's okay, you know. You're not covering murders, you're not covering presidency and all that. But I think it's pretty obvious that we know now that sports is an important part of our culture, and the way people view it is important. And I think we sometimes don't view it very reasonably. It's either, you know, it's sometimes it gets to be everything, and it's, of course it's not. So I think people who write sports, it's up to them to keep this in perspective for everybody, and the stuff about it that is important to the culture, they should emphasize, and the part that isn't, which is hard to do these days because there's so many national talk shows that have to have material every single day, and they have to talk about it for 3 hours, and the smallest controversy gets blown up into
the soap opera aspect that you were talking about before.
Well, yeah. Now I didn't mean the melodramatic part of the soap opera. I just meant the
having a storyline,
having storylines and stuff. I mean, I tried not to make too much of things that I didn't think were very important.
The job of the sports writer is to agree to sift through and tell the writer what's important.
Yeah,
whereas now, I mean, with so many different things, everything's important.
Yeah, I mean, your perspective. Yeah, you should try to have a reasonable perspective on things. I think that's an important part of it. Mm-hmm.
What does this award mean to you from the Hall of Fame?
God, it must have been a lean year for writers. I mean, I honestly thought I'd come in third.
There were three, and you came out on top. So
I've been nominated before, but I never made the top three. Mm-hmm. I think I can't remember if it was twice before. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I'm honored to be included with these guys. I don't feel like I'm Ring Lardner or did Red Smith ever win? You know, I don't feel like I'm in their company, but. If somebody wants to think so, that's fine with me.
What do you intend to say at Cooperstown?
I don't know. I have to. I'm not good at writing speeches. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind talking in public, but I have to. I don't know exactly. I don't know what I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. I hope it's appropriate. I hope it's appropriate.
It. What do you think in terms of how sports writing has changed? You know, we talked before about some of the changes that it's had in recent times. When you approach an article, do you do it any differently than you did before in terms of trying to, you know, I got the sense that the writer early on in your career was a trusted voice, that you were the liaison to the team, and now you're not quite the liaison to the team because there are many ways to get to the team. So what does the writer become?
Well, I think you still have to try to do that. Mm-hmm. You have a lot more competition. Most of your competition is not necessarily very well prepared. Mm-hmm. I mean, some guy sitting in his basement who watches games on TV and writes a blog.
Yeah.
He's just a fan. And when I say just a fan, I mean there's a difference between people that are fans and know fan things and somebody who is in the business of sports. Mm-hmm. Your perspective is different. You just look at it from a different angle. You don't look at it the way the fan does, and therefore you see things that are important that the fan doesn't, and you see things that the fan thinks important that aren't important. And fans think if they know as many facts as they can, that's all there is to it. Mm-hmm. And it's more than that. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's more knowledgeable fans and less knowledgeable fans. There's some fans who have a kind of a professional perspective, but not very many. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand why that is. Mm-hmm. And of course, you wouldn't understand unless you had a job like I had, or you were involved in baseball another way. If you were a manager, a coach, or general manager, or something, mm-hmm. it's the same thing. I was going to be a lawyer. I turned out not to be. It's fun for me to read about legal things or hear about legal things. But I know I'm not looking at it the way they do. And I'm a kind of a fan. Mm-hmm. And that's not the same thing. The only reason I know it's not is because I do this other thing where they have fans. And most of the fans don't look at it the way I do. My wife is a diehard fan of sports, especially the Indians, and but she doesn't have the same perspective. She's a fan, mm-hmm. and she knows some things that a lot of fans don't because I told her. and she knows a lot of stuff, but her perspective is not the same as mine.
It sounds as though, you know, you put a lot of stock in observing players and going with what you see, as opposed to the heavily quantitative aspect that seems to be in a lot of sports writing today. That, you know, if the quantitative were everything, you know, the NFL draft would have Hall of Famers at every position, right. You know. And in some ways, you know, there's a lot that goes into making a player. That is just whether the guy can play or whether he has the heart, stamina, you know, ability to go through the grind that the statistics may not tell you.
Well, I mean, baseball's always been a big numbers thing anyway.
Yeah.
And I used to... I would not... I'm probably not one of the... I probably never was one of the... I didn't have 55 different numbers in my stories. Mm-hmm. But there were certain things that you couldn't automatically look up in the daily notes, the stat sheet, mm-hmm. that I would try to figure out on my own. I mean, like, what's a guy's batting average bunting? Mm-hmm. I mean, a guy like Brett Butler.
Yeah.
And I would go, because I mark bunt hits in my scorebook. So I would go through and of course you're going to make mistakes. That's the other problem when you're not a computer, mm-hmm. when it's not computerized. But I would go through my scorebook and, you know, like one year he had like 18 or 20 bunt hits.
Yeah.
And, you know, his bunting average was like 430 or something. I would do things like that that weren't readily apparent. But I'm not, I'm not a fan of war. That's a parlor game to me. That doesn't mean anything. I mean, there's not they can't even agree on which formula to use to figure it out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what does that mean? This guy's 5.3 games better than a AAA player. Mm-hmm. Well, who do I do? Does that mean I trade? Do I have to trade for the guy that's 5.3 better, or the one that's 4.9 better? Am I going to actually run my team that way? Am I going to be a general manager who decides which player I trade for on the basis of that? Well, of course not. Mm-hmm. I hope it's of course not. Some of the numbers, you know, I like the data numbers, you know, well, this guy, 85% of the time he hits the ball right here on the ground. Well, yeah, stick your fielder over there. Obviously, that's valuable. You know, those kind of numbers I like. I'm not sure how valuable exit velocities and,
yeah,
you know, angles.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not sure. Do you want a guy to have this trajectory when he swings? Or, you know, I'm not so sure about those. And I know they're trying to, they're doing that because the other number said when he hit a ground ball, I hit it over here, so I don't want to hit a ground ball. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go like this. Well, maybe there's somewhere in between. I'm not sure how valuable those are.
But the pitching matchup data is particularly important these days. You know, bring a left-hander in with two outs and two strikes and all that.
I mean, Burl Weaver did that.
Yeah.
And he had his little index cards. Mm-hmm. He would play a game with the reporters every day. And he would say, Singleton's going to get two doubles and a single off of so-and-so. Because he had his little index card. Have him doing, you know, and he would do this game every day, not every day, but a lot with the writers. But he was the first, I think he was the first one I knew that did that, kept batter pitcher matchups. Those kind of things are really good. OPS, to me, OPS is not as valuable as the two numbers that make up the OPS. You could have a 300 on base percentage and a 580 slugging percentage, so you have a great OPS, but the one number is not very good at all. And it doesn't, but you don't know that if you only know the OPS, right? So why did they invent OPS? The two individual numbers tell you more than the OPS does. More accurately.
Maybe because it feels like a consolidated, you know, some way WAR is sort of a one-stop statistic.
Right.
And OPS becomes the same thing.
But it's not, you know, I want to know, well, what was the guy's, what was each number, you know, because they just because the guy's OPS is 860 doesn't mean each one was 430.
You mentioned your stories don't include a lot of numbers. Do you feel there's but isn't number driven first and foremost, at least, but do you feel fans are increasingly wanting to see numbers in their
because they think once they master the numbers they know everything that's going on. That's why the guys who do who vote according to numbers.
Yeah.
That's why they do it. Well, now I have all these numbers. I know everything, which you don't. I have so many more numbers than I used to have.
But it is going to change the Hall of Fame candidacies of a lot of guys. So it...
I think there'll be a swing. You know, these things go in cycles, too. There'll be an awareness after a while that the numbers aren't everything, that they don't work all the time. That's going to come too. I don't know how far it's going to swing the other way, but it will some.
Tell me what you're working on now and what you plan to work on in the future in terms of baseball writing.
Oh, I don't know if there's anything. if there's a kid at Revere High School who's a good baseball player, I might write a feature for him. On him for the Bath Country Journal, which I work for. But I have a part-time job with, it's a mother and her son. They operate 9 monthly magazines, Bath, Richfield, Hudson, Rexville, Broadview Heights, Twinsburg, places like that. And so I do editing. I edit a lot of stuff for them. And I do write some stories. They're not all sports, but you know, they're high school when I do write, or some kid who is in college from the area. And I also cover the Revere School Board.
Now, you've probably seen somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 Major League Baseball games over time.
I think it's like 6,000 something. I mean, covered.
Yeah, and it sounds as though you still enjoy it. Find it fresh and interesting.
Oh, I still go to the games. I still go to the games. My wife has season tickets, so she wants to go a lot. So I'll go with her, and then maybe I'll sit in the press box for five innings and then go down to her seats. Or she actually takes somebody else because I don't have to sit in her seats. You know, I can sit somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I still like to go.
Well, even though you've seen it all, or have you seen it all?
No, you never do. There's always something new. I mean, people ask me, how can you write something different when there's 200 baseball games a year? You know, spring training and postseason. I said they're all different. I mean, there's something different. One time I started thinking about, have I ever written this story before? Not exact, but like maybe a certain sentence that I've ever written this before, and I don't remember, but I think for the most part there's something different in every game, and sometimes you see things you never saw before.
Mm-hmm.
Even after you cover 6,000, whatever it is, games.
Now, Sheldon Oker, thank you so much for taking time to speak to us for this Sabre Oral History interview.
Oh, you're welcome.